Do you remember the moment that you saw yourself in God and God in you, and you were one with the universe and God and everybody? You were one with the prostitutes and pimps and priests and kings, and there was nobody on earth that was better than you nor less than you. And no one on earth was any less in Christ than anyone else.
Welcome to the Gospel Revolution Powercast for Friday, July 19, 2019, broadcasting from the heart of redemptionism, where we help you reclaim who you really are and help you remember what you did not know you'd forgotten. We're coming to you from the heart of the gospel, where we say that a text without a context is a pretext for a subtext. But right now, with more consistent, persistent, repetitive CPR of the gospel, is the president and founder of the gospel revolution, Michael Williams. Mr. Williams, how are you this fine day?
Good morning, Don Bartlett. I am doing very well. It's a day where we are missing the rain, the bad rain from the storm coming up the Gulf, but I would say you guys are going to get just a little bit of it. So,
man, we've missed it so far, and it is a big one. It is huge. Such a rain depression. I mean, covers half the continent near enough. But anyway, there you go. That's how we do weather here in the USA, because we just do everything better.
It's
better.
Done.
It's always better.
How is your day today?
Real good, mate. Really good. I am happily ensconced in my office behind the golden microphone in the fortress of common sense here. My wife is in bed. She's happy. I think everyone's
awesome.
Happy. Yeah.
That's very good. Well, it's nice to hear that things are well there in the southern part of Alabama. My goodness.
Northern part of Alabama. Northern part. Just listen, just because you...
You are in the north?
Yeah, I'm just south of Huntsville.
Well, it's south of me, okay?
Mate, south of you. Look, you leave where I live alone, and I'll leave where you live alone. Folks are dumb where I come from. We ain't had very much learning. Oh, boy. How's life with Gail? Is it is everything fine?
It's good. Everything's good. On Sunday, we went to the Oak Ridge Playhouse, which put on an absolutely a smashing job of Dolly Parton's movie, converted into a stage play, 9 to 5.
Did Dolly come at all? I mean, she just lives up the road.
No, she wasn't here. They had some video. She kind of directed the whole thing, emceed, I suppose, the play. And it really worked out great. I've never seen that done before, but it really was. The local talent here is great. I had the wonderful opportunity of seeing Les Miserables in New York City, and also in London, and also in Sydney, Australia.
Wow.
Where the Sydney theater there, you can hear the public transit running underground behind the theater while you're sitting there watching.
So. Oh, you're kidding. What theater? Was, it certainly wasn't the Opera House then. What theater was it?
I'm not sure it was, but it was the theater was down, of course, and under, and yeah, you could hear the transits running just occasionally. They'd rumble through. It was a very interesting addition to that.
There is a very old pub right in the dead center of Sydney, and it sports what's called the Marble Bar. The Marble Bar has at one end a picture of a naked woman who was apparently very attractive in the 1800s. I don't know. She doesn't quite look what, you know, a centerfold now would look like. But it's called the Marble Bar. It's been there for 100 and yonks years, and you can't hear any train. You see, we do our pubs better than we do our playhouses, and there's a reason for it. Anyway.
So, but that went very, very well. It was nice to see her so engaged. She loved it. And
stayed attentive all the way?
Stayed attentive all the way. Very, very much so. And her being a working girl all of her life, she had many things to relate to in the show. and you know, the way the workplace was in the 80s for women. And I am sure that she had a lot of reflections that were going on. It was really fun to see her so captivated by something. After the first act, she was saying how good it was, and she was ready to go home. And
then, oh, wow.
Then I told her, well, it's, that's just the first one. Oh, really? And so we she got settled back in again, though, and then thoroughly enjoyed the second part, which is half the length of the first, which I was glad of that. Because I could tell that it was going to come to a point where that she was just, her attentiveness was going to run out.
But it never did. You know, you need to be careful of calling her a working girl. In other parts of the world where this podcast goes, working girl can mean something quite different, I think, than what
you
mean.
I know. That is true.
Yep. There's a whole bunch of them. We could spend an hour on that.
Well, we could, and actually we spend every hour that we're on here doing that. That's why we go into the Greek, because some of these inflections and these ways of saying things have been imposed during the translation of what we have as the Bible, Old Testament and New.
You trying to steer this back to safe ground?
We're trying so hard, yes.
Well, not before I tell my Aussie story.
Well, tell an Aussie story. Go ahead. I'm feeling very generous this morning.
Well, thank you, Massa. Thank you. No, in Australia, Queensland beer, 4X. It's a good beer. It's a real nice beer, actually, 4X. And they used to have an ad saying, I can feel a 4X coming on. I can feel a 4X coming on. And it was a great little ad, and everyone was singing it and that. And then somebody started singing it in England, where 4X is actually a condom.
Oh, no.
I'll leave you with the rest.
Well, I think we've gotten our point across this morning, which was unintended, but I think apropos.
Of course it was intended. I intended it.
Certainly was apropos to the things that we're studying as we go through here. And we really try to get to the bottom of those. What did these people mean when they said this? And did they really say it? And how much has this English translation imposed itself over this, in the New Testament, over this Greek? How much did the Greek impose over the Aramaic? And they are, you know, these things are, to a large extent, discoverable and relatively easy to discover.
Well, there's more than just that. There's also 600 years of human English language history that goes between, say, 1611, and did I say 600? There's 400 going on, 500. Between 1611 and 2018. So, I mean, back in those days, if you hit someone on the head and they saw stars, that person then qualified to be called amazed. Amazed meant you were seeing stars.
Oh, wow.
But now, it means nothing of the. Back then, to let something was to hinder it. It's still used today in legal papers. But today, to let something is the entire opposite. It means to permit something.
No, and you know, we're still just barely hanging on to the term raise. You talk to anybody and you tell them you're going to raise a house or raise a barn, and that means you're going to build a barn, right? You're going to build a house.
Uh-huh.
But the term raise, in even my younger years, we knew that that term meant, it had a dual meaning, actually, and since then, I think it's just graduated on to mean to construct. But raising something is to tear it down. So, these things evolve in their meaning. We can read something and think we absolutely know exactly what they're talking about. But just even in our from my childhood to, my children's childhood, and even more so now, if I would have said, you know, we're going to raise this, they're going to raise this house, they would have had absolute assurity that we were talking about building a house instead of tearing one down. So,
well, in the backpackers at Caloundra, where I first met Mike Williams via a tape, I met another young fella who was very earnest, and he was a John MacArthur fan, and so, of course, he bought a John MacArthur Bible, and he was sitting in the common room, and I come up and said, "How you doing, mate?" And he said, "Good, I'm just reading." I said, "Oh, can I see what you're reading?" He was reading some obscure passage in one of the prophets or something, and it was, and it said, "I will shew."
Yes.
"I will shew this for you, O man," and da 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 da. And I said, "Oh, that's an interesting verse. Tell me, what's it mean?" And he couldn't tell me what it meant. I said, "Well, let's just do it by the words. What's that word there, shew, mean?" Couldn't tell me what shew mean. He had been raised with show, and could in no way even start to begin to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, I never made too much fun of him, but I just wondered how many people are reading a language they don't even understand.
Mm-hmm.
Forget the fact that, I mean, even that simple. Forget the fact of raised.
Very simple.
And yes. Yeah, just very simple.
Yeah.
And there is in America, thank God not anywhere else, I think. If you find them, you're going to have to kill one for Christmas, friends. But these people who say a King James Version is the only version. Yeah, good luck with that. I can take you to multiple. What is the man? I loved it when I was a kid. My grandpa pointed this out to me, that in the Old Testament, "And you must kill everyone that pisseth against the wall." Now, I am quoting the Bible. Family, I am quoting the Bible. Don't even bother calling in. And Danny Rouse, this goes through. This does not get stopped. "You got to kill everyone that pisseth against the wall." They couldn't even say every male. They couldn't even say everyone that had a willy. Oh, dear, oh, dear. I don't know. What do you do with that, mate?
Nothing. No, it's. I think we've established the point as to why that we do some labor over this.
Let us both say this: we both study out of the King Jimmy.
Yes,
we were just raised that way, you know.
Well,
we know what the bloody language means.
Yes, and the confusion that we are trying to break through and to throw some sunlight on it was brought on by the King James Version. So I can't think, I think there's much more integrity in what we're doing, Don, than just switching versions, saying, "Oh, we just don't like that." Well, people who are stuck here and are using the King James Version, you've got to deconstruct that for them in this Bible. This is the Bible that transformed the world. This is the version that transformed the world.
No other Bible had nearly as much influence.
So, you know, when we talk about different versions of the Bible, I have no affinity for one over the other. I do not like the NIV because of its deliberate translation to validate Christianity and their preconceived notions. And
it's a bit of a hybrid, the nearly inspired version, because it was one of the first versions to do away with the mythological translation into the Vulgate of the word hell.
Yeah,
it was good for that, at least.
It was, and so goodness. But I always tell everybody, enjoy every translation. I've got about 13 on my research, and I can check into any one of them. Even a Spanish version, if I want to know what it says in Spanish, which wouldn't help me at all.
But it makes you sound good. I mean, yeah. don't explain it; just say it, mate.
Just the fact that you have it makes you scholarly. You know.
There you go.
So this study in Hebrews, I mean, this has This has been a highlight of a decade, really, for me. I look back over the evolution of the gospel revolution, and we've had tremendous insights, just too many to even name, over the last decade. It's just been everything's obsolete that we taught before that, in terms of having complete thought to it, as compared to where we are now. And going into this in Hebrews has been that going into the Apollos project, I'm still just dumbstruck with the gravity of what we're doing here, Don. Nobody's ever done this. I mean, there's a lot of things that we think we might be the first. We think we might be the voice that has brought clarity to something for the first time. There's a whole bunch of those. And could we ever write an entire volume of books of things that just the things that the gospel revolution has brought out the first time. One of them, which is such a simple thing, is I am the Lord God, I change not. And
oh yeah,
I mean, there's one of those examples that a predetermined view of something caused the translation to turn out just the opposite to what the statement was in Hebrew.
Yeah.
And it actually says, I'm the Lord God. I never do anything the same way twice. And it's just as clear as a bell. Things like that, the gospel of revolution has debunked so much. And one of our last full teachings on Hebrews was Hebrews debunked.
Yep.
And we didn't know how much more debunking that Hebrews needed at the time, about 4 years ago or so. And here we are still doing the same thing. But that excites me, because if there's not proof in just the fact that we're going through this again, and we are finding things we never saw the first time, we're not doing this just to reaffirm, yes, we were right, yes, we were right. In fact, you've heard us read through this and say, wow, we were wrong, wow, we were wrong, wow, we were wrong, way more times than we've said, yeah, this confirms what I was teaching on 10 years ago, 5 years ago.
Gospel revolution.
So we finished up in Hebrews chapter 11. From there, we went on the spree that we did last week on navigating and negotiating through life with ourselves and with others and with life itself. We've gotten a lot of comments on that this was something that was very helpful. To proceed into chapter 12, it is just absolutely imperative that we read verse 39 and 40, because chapter 12 starts with wherefore.
And, there you go.
And because there's a wherefore there, we must read verse 39 and 40. And then we will go from there. Are you ready for the Apollos project? I don't know which number this is, but
are you ready to rumble? Okay, I reckon I am. And these all, having obtained a good report. Now, these people got a good report.
Yeah.
This is the heroes of faith, you know, the whole bunch of them. Through faith, it doesn't say their faith.
No.
Received not the promise. And these all, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise.
In fact, Don, I think we have to assume what the writer has said and what Paul says is that these all having obtained a good report through God's faith, received God's faith, did not give them the promise. Now, how can we call it God's faith? Because he starts out this chapter, through faith, we understand that the worlds were framed together. Well, that's not ours.
Yep.
So, and the subject never changes from there as to whose faith we're talking about.
And for the most part, these individuals were moved by fear. Yeah. He even says that in verse, I think it's 6 with Noah. But certainly with other ones, what caused Moses' parents to hide him in a basket?
Mm-hmm.
It was fear.
Yeah.
It wasn't faith. But God's faith saw it through.
And prostitution and all of this. I think it's more of a picture of, regardless of how miserably people fail, God's faith accomplishes what God's faith wants to do. That is the big Hebrews 11 revelation, isn't it, Don? That regardless of the weaknesses, the insecurities, mocking God, prostitution, moral failures, all kinds of negative human attributes, God's faith still pulled it off.
Yeah.
That's the big news about Hebrews chapter 11.
Yep.
And we've attributed this faith to the people. The really disingenuous and their intellectual dishonesty about calling this the faith of these people, when their own teachings say what these people experienced during these, quote, times of faith, they teach against all the time that those things mean you have no faith, from moral failure to fear and all the way through all of these.
Yep.
So what Hebrews 11 has established for us is that regardless of the weaknesses, the fears, the moral failures, God's faith still delivers. But what we know it did not deliver to them is the promise. And the promise, according to Paul, is righteousness. They did not receive the righteousness, which is by faith.
Now, you would think that the next verse would explain something about them, but it doesn't. It explains something about us.
Yeah.
So, these all, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise, God having provided some better things for us.
Yeah.
That they, without us, should not be made complete.
Yeah, and that completion is righteousness. And this, really, the verse isn't even about us. Again, it's about God. God having provided.
Okay.
So it's not about us. It's about what God did with us and them that was laid out. God determined to demonstrate what his faith would do on behalf of a human vessel who fails at faith on every turn. The Word of Faith movement gets this so screwed up, they quote from here and say that Abraham called those things that be not as though they were. And it comes nowhere near saying that. It says, even God, who quickeneth the dead and calleth those things that be not as though they were. In spite of being mocked by Abraham and Sarah, in spite of going out and getting a concubine to fulfill the promise of God, you can't stop what God's faith does, whether you try to add to it or you do something that would detract from it.
Is there any best age I should look for a concubine?
No, I'm sorry, Don. The validation of those reasons has passed with the old covenant.
God's always against me.
I know. You're so disappointed. But it's for your good.
Right? Like the guy said, you know, money doesn't buy you happiness. And yeah, I wouldn't mind finding out for myself, if you don't mind. So that brings us to verse 1 of chapter 12 of the book of Hebrews.
Yes.
Which reads, wherefore?
Oh my, what a big word.
Yeah, well, in the light of everything that went before, in the chapter before, wherefore, seeing we are also compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us.
So here we have these first two verses here. They are so loaded. Now, we didn't load them. They have been loaded by Apollos for 11 chapters. He's loaded this for bear because he knows what he's going for. These people are wanting to go back, and chapter 12 is the stupid? You want to go back? Well, let me tell you what you're going back to. Don't forget this part. Now, since we've got this, you know, I remember being in the Word of Faith movement, and we were so segmented by chapter and verse. I remember people reading, "Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with a great cloud of witnesses." I wonder who that cloud of witnesses are. If that's our man, that's Mama and Daddy and all the people that have gone before us. Mm. And it's like, what in the world? You see, even what happened for our convenience, this being divided up into chapter and verse, has brain chained us to not be able to complete the thought previous to nor following any chapter or any verse. It has verse damned us. And man, what was our mantra? Find a verse, chapter and verse, and stand on it. Don't move away from the chapter and the verse.
Yep.
Well, you may be standing on the most ignorant presumption that you could possibly come up with out of anything biblical.
I know some people who stood on the verse of, "And Judas went out and hung himself. Go and do thou likewise." Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And millions of others, honestly, as many verses as there are, those many verses have been taken out of context. But here, we don't have to wonder who this great cloud of witnesses are. And what did they witness? Now, let's stop and see what they witnessed. They witnessed the fact that regardless of them being so inept, so distracted, filled with fear, corruption, that God's faith still worked. That's what they witnessed.
That had to come as a bit of a surprise for some of them, didn't it?
Well, such a surprise that the entire Christian world has never figured this out. But here in the Gospel Revolution, this has become just as clear as a bell. Number one, we read in context. Number two, we've accepted who the author is. And we know that his writings are built on Paul's teachings. What a powerful place to come from in trying to gain insight into these writings. And so let's, first off again, let's affirm what this great cloud of witnesses witnessed. They witnessed this fact: my morality, my attempt to get the promise to work, my fear, my humanness in all of its entirety cannot prevent the faith of God from accomplishing what it set out to do. The one thing that it never accomplished, because God had set this promise up for a later time to benefit all people, was righteousness through the faith of God. God's righteousness through God's faith. And I was saying this on our on my Tuesday night Bible study, you know, how foolish it is to think that God's righteousness would operate by our faith. It just, you know, until you stop and look at it, you realize this is really kind of stupid. We talk about that it's God's righteousness. We don't disagree with that. But then we have the audacity and the ignorance, really, of saying that operates by our faith. It just right off the bat, it just sounds really stupid. And the fact is, it really is very stupid.
Well, let us read verse 2, chapter 12, verse 2, looking.
Well, we've not finished with the middle of chapter 1. Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us. Now, the sin that has beset the entire world from Adam on was unbelief. The conclusion here in chapter 1, verse 1, is we've seen that man's failures cannot stop God's faith. So why should we let our own faith become a weight to us? Because unbelief cured by man's faith is no cure, is it, Don?
Say that again so I can understand it.
Man's faith is no cure for unbelief. That's not the cure. If unbelief is built in, then the cure cannot be man's faith. It is just not possible. Now, he's saying this is the thing that so easily besets us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. Now, I made this statement the other day too, and I lifted my hands on my own show and gave thanks to God for the day I was delivered from my own faith. And I felt that deeply. So what was I doing? What was that expression when I literally raised my hands last Tuesday night and gave thanks to God for the day I was freed from my own faith? What was I doing? I was rejoicing about the time that I laid aside the weight that so easily beset me. Now I get to run this race with patience. In fact, Don, before we go on, what does that word patience mean? What are we running with? Let's make sure we're clear about what we got in exchange for what we had. And in today's Christian world, this is what we're appealing to you, is drop this pursuit of your own faith. Drop this pursuit of trying to get rid of your own unbelief and accept the faith of Christ, because then you'll be able to run this race with patience.
Hupomone in the Greek means as Superman is demolishing the big criminal setup, he has a grin on his face.
Wow.
That's what it means.
Well, it just had to be more than just patience as we know it, quietly sitting and waiting for something to happen. And that's passive. So there's nothing passive about patience here. Is that right?
No, I think it's a determination. You know you are going to get to the end. You know you have a focus point, which is the result of everything you're doing. And you are both internally and externally very happy because of it.
Man, that's awesome. So now let's place this again in Apollos' time with the people he's talking to. What race is he expecting them to run? The only race that this is not a race to the finish of their lives. This is not a race to get to salvation. That certainly would not fit in the context of this. They were running for their lives. They were running, trying to break away from the doctrines they had been placed under. And I'm sorry, I got to say it again, by Peter, James, and John. They were these appeals to go back. He's saying you've got to put some aggressive action into with your mind at peace to get out of this mess that you're in. And this is how we do that. How do we proceed from here? Looking at what this great cloud of witnesses has shown us, therefore we can lay aside this weight. Obviously, based on chapter 11, we can lay aside the weight of our own performance, our own faith, all of these things, and let's boogie on out of here. Let's move on out of chapter 6 even. Let us leave behind. Now, that would be a persistence. That would be a movement from one place to another. So if we are running this with patience, he's already told us the track. What track are you on if you're running a race? You know, the track that he set up in chapter 6 was getting out from these former doctrines. So that's the race that is set up by Apollos here, is make haste, get out of these things. And man, you can do it with absolute confidence. So then verse 2, looking unto, and what do we do as we do this? What is going to be the thing that takes us from where we were to where we're going? Which, remember, we're not going into righteousness. Now, we're not going into perfection. We've already got that according to this writer. We're not going into the kingdom. We're not trying to get someplace. We're not. We're trying to get out of the only race mentioned here in Hebrews is getting out of Christian doctrine into the completed work of Christ. Verse 2.
Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God.
Well, again, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher, this was a huge thing in the gospel revolution 25 years ago. When we simply slowed down and acknowledged that the term our is italicized. And he is the author, he is the finisher of faith. Man, and just think about the chapter we've just been through. He authored it, he finished it, even in light of all the failures of this list of people. How did these things get accomplished? It was by the faith of God, regardless of their fears, regardless of anything. I'm sorry, I know I'm repeating myself, but you see, folks, we have been so chained to another thought, it's going to maybe take several jerks on your chain to break this thing loose from you, that this hall of fame of faith, this... This should be, if we're talking about the folks in there, we should have it the Hall of Fame of Failures, where God's faith superseded it. That's what it should be the Hall of Fame of. Now, if it's the Hall of Fame of Faith, we're doing the Hall of Fame of how God's faith operated in spite of humanity, in spite of its morality, in spite of all of the fear and the things that the people experienced here, God's faith still pulled these things off. I'm just excited about this. I'm sorry.
Verse 3, for consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, unless you be wearied and faint in your minds.
He's comparing this running with patience, us getting through this departure from doctrines. He's telling us that Jesus, this is how Jesus did it, for the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down as this is the thing. Folks, you're running toward complete rest. That's what this process is going to bring you in breaking away from the doctrines of John the Baptist. That's where this is going to bring you. And keep that joy set before you. What is our joy? Our joy, by comparison, is Christ, looking unto Jesus. That's our joy. And it was his faith and his patience. And while we're running this race, consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself. He's not saying you're going to endure the contradiction of sinners. He's simply comparing the contradictions they're going to face with the contradictions of sinners that Jesus faced. They're not facing the contradiction of sinners, but Apollos is comparing Jesus accomplishing what he did in contradiction of the sinners against himself, lest you be weary and faint in your minds. Now, wow. You know one thing we've experienced in the process of the gospel revolution, Don?
What's that?
We have experienced people getting weary and fainting in their minds. They just don't want to put the effort into it anymore. I am just tired of having to learn more. I am tired of having to push on here. If there's any things that I'd like to apologize is that we didn't understand all of this from day one, 35 years ago. We didn't understand it all. And we've had to persevere in the teaching. We've had to persevere in the research. But we've really had several people who've just come to a point where that they just don't want anything to do anymore. So we would really encourage you, because if you don't embrace going forward, guess where you're going to go? You're going to go backward. And the writer of Hebrews here is going to tell you what you will eventually embrace again if you don't keep up this persistence and walk away from these former doctrines.
Couple of parallels here are interesting. Consider him that endured such contradiction against of sinners against himself. That word endured is hupomeno, again, the same one that is translated as run with patience.
Oh, wow. So it is a direct comparison to what we are doing. Yeah.
Well, direct. And the second interesting thing in this verse is the last word, minds. That mind word is psuche, which is the New Testament, the Greek equivalent of the Hebrew nefesh, meaning soul.
Mm.
So when we talked in the past about your soul being your mind, will, and emotions, here is a really good example of the translators saying, well, soul means minds. And psuche, which is the Greek, simply means the soul. You can go through with Bible Hub. You can check every single instance of this word out, and you'll find that it's mostly translated as soul, but often as mind. So this is mind in comparison with the other Greek word for mind, meaning nous, N-O-U-S, or nous. I think it's different for a reason.
Awesome. And what do you see that? The reason for that difference again, Don?
Well, I think the Bible itself, or the writer here, Apollos himself, is likening our souls to that part of us in which we can faint and relax.
Yes.
And let go of what we're supposed to be enduring for.
Yeah. Well, the context would support that, doesn't it?
I think so. You have not, verse 4, you have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin.
Oh, man. And how many of us take this out of context and says, see there, we're supposed to resist all the way to giving our blood, striving against sin. No, he says, you haven't done this. And guess what? You don't have to do it.
Now, he's not talking about persecution here.
No.
He's talking about sin. Hamartia.
Yes.
Yeah.
You have not done that. But guess who did do that?
Because the person who made sin his footstool.
Yes, and the person who, it says right here that he resisted against sin. And he's saying, you have not resisted unto blood, striving against sin. Now, you are striving against something, but guess what you're not striving against?
There you go.
Folks, you got it made here. You got it made. You just don't know. My gosh, you don't know. This whole group of people we just went through in Hebrews chapter 11, they were still striving against sin. Thank you, Apollos. For letting us know that we do have a race to run. We do have a striving to work for, against something and for something, to move towards something. But guess what it is not against? It's not against sin. Wow. You know, out of verse 4, I guess, comes all of the folks that are beating themselves to where the blood comes out. They're resisting sin to the point of blood, right?
Yeah, in the Philippines, they crucify themselves at Easter time.
Yes, just to portray that they are resisting sin to the point of blood. Well, I'm sorry, your resistance, even to the point of blood, is moot. There is, you've done all that for no reason. Why? Because you've already got that. Because the one who had to strive and resist and overcome sin was Christ. Now, the only thing you got to deal with, dummy, is overcome your bad doctrine. Man, Don, this is just, I mean, Apollos is so artful in putting this together and letting us know how fortunate we are. You're not striving against sin. You're not having to, folks, we're not asking you for blood. We're not asking you to put effort into this that's going to bleed you dry financially or any other way. We're just asking you to not be mentally and emotionally lazy and stop and settle because, oh, you heard this, you heard that. But, I mean, where else would you find this content being broken down in context, being supported by the Greek words as we go? We've got the proper comparison here. Don, I'll tell you, I never drew out this proper comparison, such obvious comparison between Christ, between our battle and Christ's battle. Have you seen this before?
No.
I have not. I rejoice in those I have never seen this before moments because that's what makes verse 4 understandable. You're not doing this. Come on. All you got to do is put a little effort in here, but it's not effort. The battle with sin is over, so you don't have to do that. You're not striving to the point of shedding blood like Christ did to deal with sin. You're not having to do that. So come on, let's put some effort in this, in what we really need to know. And what we really need to do, and that is, as he learned from Paul, the saving of the soul and the renewing of the mind. Come on, let's get these old doctrines out of here so that you can have this absolute peace. You can have the same kind of peace in your life that Jesus found after he won against sin. And all you've got to do to have that position of knowing that sin is under your feet, which that's what he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God for, wasn't it, Don? Was to make sin his footstool?
Uh-huh.
Now, you can do that too if you just win this battle in your mind. Don't faint because everything around you is religious. Just because everything around you, just because Peter, James, and John didn't get it, just because the church at Galatia forsook Paul completely and gave in back to this doctrine, influenced by people who were influenced by James, that doesn't mean you have to. Please don't go that route. We all been there. Don's been there. I've been there. Everybody in the sound of our voice has been down that path. We've tried to duplicate the sacrifice of Christ. We've tried to do for Christ what he seems to not been able to do for himself or for us. So we're having to do it. Get off of that treadmill because it's going nowhere and start running a race as fast as you can out of Christian doctrine into understanding the gospel, because the striving against sin has already been done. The striving against sin has been completed, and you've not done that. And he might have followed up with this. You've not been striving all the way to blood against sin, and you will never have to. So what are you doing?
Before I read the next few verses, I want to underscore the fact that this chapter is talking about Jesus. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down on the right hand of the throne of God. Looking unto Jesus, We're now going to read the verses that follow, looking unto Jesus. Mm-hmm. I'm reading from verse 5. And you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks unto you as unto children. Now he's going to quote from the Old Testament.
Yes.
My son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. Mm-hmm. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son whom he receives. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons, for what son is he whom the Father does not chasten?
Mm. Boy, you talk about a huge picture of where you have slidden back to. If you think this is all about you, this is where you're going. Now, if you get weary and faint in your mind, the first thing is going to go is your memory. Right?
Yep. Uh-huh.
If you get weary and faint in your mind, it's going to cause you to forget. And he's asking them, have you gotten weary? Have you been striving against sin when you're not supposed to be? Have you been fighting for something that already exists? Have you been trying to accomplish something that's already been done instead of the battle you should be fighting? Man, I tell you what, I see Christianity standing out there as a beacon to keep you fighting against the thing that's already been accomplished so they can keep you in bondage to them.
Because if you stay busy,
yes,
you can't think.
You can't think, especially when you can't see the goal. You know the goal will never be reached, but you need more effort to reach a goal you can't see and you can't achieve.
The hamster is dead, but the wheel is still turning.
Dear God, what a perfect picture for us, Don. Now, this is what happens, though, if you don't remember, if you faint in your mind and start thinking that this is about a battle with sin, if sin is still a problem, now he said lay aside that weight, right?
Uh-huh.
All right, so if you think sin is still a problem, then this is the other problem that you have.
Oh, boy.
All right? So now remember he said that, have you forgotten the exhortation which speaketh, and like you said, he is quoting now the Old Testament, or have you forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as unto children? But see, we're not children anymore.
Exactly. I was just going to say, in Ephesians, Paul makes a great argument that you are not children, you are sons.
And Apollos is picking up on that here.
Uh-huh.
You see the magic that this is creating? I mean, I don't know anything else to call it. Paul's teaching shining through at a moment here that we really need a background to this. He says, have you forgotten what it was like to be under the Old Testament? Have you forgot what it was like to be children rather than to be sons? Have you forgotten? If you're still fighting against sin, guess what? If you're still trying to attain righteousness, guess what? If you are still a child, guess what? Don't despise the chastening of the Lord and faint not when you are rebuked of him. You not only have lost your way in the woods as to what you're actually fighting against, now you have God fighting against you too.
Oh, boy.
I mean, God's just going to beat the crap out of you every time you make a wrong step. You see, they had humanized the old covenant. They just thought this was all about them, and now they are going, just do the best you can. That's what Christians say today. Well, I see, we're free from the law, yeah. But, God does, and no, none of us are perfect, but God does expect you to try. Really? Where is that verse? All I expect is that you try. Yeah, I know you're a bunch of prostitutes and pimps and full of fear and all of this. I get it, guys. I get it. But could you just try? Where did that doctrine come from? And that's the only thing they've got to fall back on, Don.
Well, the person's coming to God and says, this is all I've got. His hands are cupped and he's got a little baggage in his hands. This is all I've got. And Jesus condescendingly says, and that's all I want, son. It is so sick.
It is sick. It's so self-righteous. It's so, it is all self. You're worshiping yourself to say that. It's like, look, I only had a little, but he took what I got, and he approved me based on what I've got.
It all becomes transactional.
Oh, man, good statement.
Touched this week by the thought of John Calvin. Now, John Calvin was a lawyer. So when he came to look at the Bible, he looked at it as a lawyer would. Well, there's got to be some quid pro quo here. There's got to be some give and take, some tit for tat. There's got to be a transaction. But, salvation and redemption never were a bargain to be struck. They were a gift like oxygen just to be bloody enjoyed.
Yes. Yeah, and what you do with your oxygen is up to you.
I've thought of oxygen when I keep hearing people say, yeah, you've got to receive the gift. You've got to receive it. It's a gift, but you've got to receive it. Well, what the hell is the oxygen thing? When God created the world and created us and created oxygen, did we have to receive the oxygen?
Make a decision to receive the oxygen.
Oh, boy.
A baby doesn't make a choice when it comes out of his mother's womb to take that first breath.
No, but it's a gift. No, it's a gift. He has to make a decision.
Yeah. And he has to know to make a decision before he even knows what a decision is, or even words to put it together. Folks, that's how inept we were at gaining righteousness. We were like a newborn babe. And I'm telling you, the only way you can look at this is the picture that Don has just portrayed you. How did you get this righteousness? It was through the second birth, but that second birth took place 2,000 years ago. And you know what? At that second birth, you didn't have to have any knowledge, training, the ability to feed yourself, the ability to stand up, the ability to do anything. All you had to do is breathe. And you didn't even have to think about that. And that really is such a wonderful picture for us, Don, as to how the planet received righteousness at the second birth. And why wouldn't we come up with that analogy? Because if he's comparing this righteousness that comes by a second birth, wouldn't it be comparable then to the first birth, the human birth into this world? What is the thing that makes a difference between life and death? You got to breathe. What makes the difference between life in Christ and not life in Christ? It's righteousness. How does it come? Just like breathing. If you're existing, you're righteous. Folks, if you're existing, you're righteous. The same as if you're breathing, you're alive. If you're not, you're dead. If you are existing, you are righteous. Let us tell the entire population of this world right now, Don, if you are living, you are righteous.
I sat in a meeting once, and a speaker said, how you can tell when a man's ready for sex? There are certain giveaway signs. And about that time, every breath in that 5,000-member auditorium just stopped. Are you really going to go there? Are you really going to go there? He said, yep, there's one absolute certain physical sign that you can tell when a man is ready for sex. He's breathing. Well, it's kind of the same thing. You can tell when a man's ready for life. He's breathing.
Yeah. And we can tell whether or not you're righteous. You're alive.
Uh-huh.
Now, folks, that's what, see, Apollos' mindset is this. He is befuddled by the ignorance that has gotten into these people who are still stuck in the doctrines that he came out of. He's appealing with all of his heart. This is not that complicated, folks. You didn't have to strive against sin. You didn't have to shed blood. There's only one that had to do that. Come on. Stop fighting a fight that's been won and fight the fight of your life to keep them from choking the life out of you with these old doctrines. Call to remembrance. Okay, so you've forgotten. Oh, okay, so you think this is your battle, right? So you think, yeah, you think sin is still an issue, right? Well, have you forgotten this? This is how God deals with sin before Christ. Before we, now, if we're not going to look unto Jesus, let's look unto the law. We're going to take a little break now, since I'm having a hard time getting you to look unto Jesus, the author and finisher of faith. Let's look back before Christ and see what it was like before Christ did his job. And here's what it was like. Read those three verses again for us, please, Don.
Consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest you be weary and faint in your souls. You have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin, and you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks unto you as unto children. My son, don't despise the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when you are rebuked of him. In other words, take it like a man. Yeah. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son whom he receives. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is he whom the Father chastens not? But if we be without chastisement, whereof all are partakers, remember this is the Old Testament. Remember he's quoting the Old Testament. He's not giving them a New Testament exhortation here.
Exactly.
But if you be without chastisement, whereof all are partakers, then are you bastards and not sons. You haven't come the prescribed way.
Oh, man. Yeah. It's like while you're having fun at church, while you're having fun practicing your doctrines, remember, with those doctrines go this.
Now, that's what this whole book is about. This whole book is about, in past times and in divers manners, God did this. But now we have Jesus, who's a little higher than the angels, who's a little better than Moses.
Started out that way, didn't
it? Yeah. Better than Moses, better than Melchizedek, better than anyone you care to talk about. He's better. So let's have a look at this comparison. And then he goes up into chapters 5, 6, 7, and he's talking about, well, this is the way we used to do it.
Yeah.
Now we got a better way. We have a better sacrifice. We have a better high priest. We have a better way. Everything's better. And now he's taking these people back to say, this is what you used to have. You want this or you want better?
Yeah. And this is the full extent of where you've gone. You think you're just going back to some rules, some feast days, you know, celebrate them if you want to. Doesn't make any difference, a dime's worth of different one way or the other. That's fine. You can do all that. The problem is you've embraced the doctrines that go along with that.
And I've already told you a couple of chapters back, there remains no more sacrifice.
Yeah, if you take that, yeah, if you take that route, just know you're stuck with sin, you know, because if you are saying that sin still exists, you've got to understand Christ died once and for all. So you can't have these two covenants mixed together. You can't continue with a mentality of continued sin, a repetitive redemption from sin, one covered, but he's saying this one's better because it takes away sin. But you see, by going back and getting back in sin again, you're going to have Jesus come and die again. You're crucifying afresh the Son of God.
Mm-hmm.
and making the blood of covenant wherewith ye were sanctified an unholy thing. It's as unholy as the old sacrifices were if it has to be done over and over and over again. Oh, man. I am thoroughly caught up in what this is saying and what we're learning here. Let's see how much further we can go here. Now what's going to come up now that he has given us this addition? If you're going under these doctrines, this is one you got to add to it. You can't be selective about your doctrines. If you're going back, go back. If you have not found peace in Christ, if you've not found your rest, and you think that it's not in Christ, then here we go. Let's go all the way back. But don't go through the intellectual dishonesty to say that the observance of these doctrines are benefiting you without taking the other side of the pill, which says these are the things that go along with that doctrine. And it is called chastening and scourging.
Verse 9. Furthermore, we have had fathers of our flesh.
Mm-hmm.
We've had natural fathers who corrected us and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much rather be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they verily for a few days chastened us after their own pleasure, but he for our profit, that we might be partakers of his holiness.
Mm-hmm. Well, and now he is comparing God to our earthly father. And he is, what has he just said here? He said, now, we told you what it's like being children under the first covenant. Now let's compare that to our natural father. How long does your natural father beat the daylights out of you? It's not when you're 30 years old. He does it for a period of time.
It's while you're a child.
It is while you are a child. Even your natural father knows that a time of chastening and scourging for someone who is grown up now has ended. Now, you've been brought from being children to sons, and now how perverse is this, folks? This is like a 40-year-old getting a spanking over the knee from his 60-year-old father.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's just perverse. I'm sorry. That is just perverse. And he's saying, you know, now, if that's the way it is, let's just submit to God and become holy then through getting beat up. If that's the path that you're going to take, stop resisting chastisement and accept every bad thing in your life as chastisement. Well, that's what the Christian world has done, hasn't it, Don?
Man, and how? Well, what you said earlier is what the Christian church has done, and you can mix law and the old covenant and the new. You can. All you got to do is make it, take it, the words of the old or the new covenant, and make them mean whatever the heck you want.
Yes. Yeah, take out the sting. You know, take out the consequences. Go for the blessings. Forget that if you break one law, you've broke them all.
Mm.
This selectiveness of going through, how dare you? Anybody that claims they can be blessed by God by keeping a law has insulted the scriptures to the highest order.
Mm.
Anyone that thinks you can be cursed by disobeying a law, you've insulted the scriptures to the highest order, because the scriptures, the law, make it very clear that number one, if you break any law, you've broke them all. So stop doing this and disrespecting God's law by saying you can get blessed by keeping a law, and stop disrespecting God's law by saying if you break one, you're going to get chastised for breaking that law. There was only one way to break this cycle of the law, and that's the sacrifice of Christ, which took us out of that system altogether. You don't get blessed for doing good, and you do not get cursed for doing wrong. Mm. A whole new world has dawned upon us.
Verse 11, now no chastening for the present seems to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them who are exercised thereby. Wherefore, and I'm going to go into this next verse to make a point, wherefore lift up the hands which hang down and the feeble knees. If you are living in the atmosphere of chastisement, if you are living in the atmosphere of the old covenant, if you are wanting to go back to that, your hands are hanging down and your knees are feeble.
Yep. But, you know, Don, I'm sorry, I'm having flashbacks to my last Tuesday so many times. The one thing, now I don't do this online. I don't lift my hands to show any outward sign of praise or anything like that. But when I was talking about being freed from my own faith, my hands automatically went up in the air. I couldn't have kept them down, to tell you the truth.
Did you speak in tongues?
No, I sure didn't.
Why not?
But I could have.
Aren't you a real man of God?
Yes, whether I speak in tongues or not.
But you were sitting down. No one could see if you had feeble knees.
No one could see. I felt like getting up and dancing, but nobody wanted to see that either. So, but I'm telling you, this was a physical thing that happened to me. People, you need to get set free from your own faith. That's what this chapter 11 is about, your own faith, your own righteousness, your own personal sin. You need to get set free from your own personal Jesus. You really desperately need to be freed from your own personal Jesus. Jesus is the Redeemer of the world. Let's expand that horizon. Stop making Jesus your little cash cow. Stop making Jesus your personal counselor. Stop making Jesus your personal little everything, because you're minimizing the work of the cross, this magnificent work that brought us out of one covenant and brought us firmly into a covenant to where that there's no such thing as chastisement. You know, and so what do we do? I remember Jim Richards. This is where when it came to tithing, Jim Richards divided with me completely, and right after he heard me teach, he got up in his own church and says, if you don't tithe, you might as well hang a flag up over your house that says, cursed. That was Jim Richards' response to my saying that tithing was not for the new covenant. And this was the other, and he would read through these verses and just affirm that chastening. Now, what they do is they try to water down chastening. This one Jim did a sideswipe on me. He caught me in the car with the pastor driving, he and I both, to the church where we were going to be speaking in. I was in the back seat. Jim got in the front seat with the pastor, and he starts explaining to me about the word chastening. And of course, he had already talked to the pastor about this, and so he was now going to correct me and in front of the pastor about my teachings on that this chapter was talking about the old covenant. Mike says, chastening means correction. It says God gives us correction. It says chastening doesn't mean. And I said to him, well, what does scourgeth mean? And that's when I just became rebellious. You know, you're just not willing to hear. You're not willing to listen, Mike. Me and the pastor are both very sorry. But before we go into these meetings, we need it understood that you are wrong and we are right about this. So that was the totality of the initial schism that came between me and my friend Jim Richards, which led to a, what was it, 30-page diatribe that we read again, that he wrote against me.
Yep.
And but folks, what do we do with the prophecy in Isaiah that says the chastisement of our peace was upon him. How do you take that and try to preach chastening and scourging under the new covenant? Isn't it Jesus who resisted unto blood against sin? Wasn't it he who took the chastening and the scourging? It says he was scourged. That same word is used when it talks about the sacrifice of Christ. He was scourged. He was chastened. And Isaiah said the chastisement of our peace. What is the writer here talking about? Us finding a place of peace? The same way Christ is seated at the right hand of the throne of the Father, completely at rest. How do you find that rest? You're going to have to find it by getting rid of all these doctrines that include chastening and scourging. This powerful prophecy, the chastisement of our peace was upon him.
And so it is that we must leave you, family and friends. If you'd like to know anything about the Gospel of Revelation, then call us at our office on
832-318-9339.
And speak to us about how you want to participate. If that call goes unanswered, there's a good reason for it, but it will become answered. Just leave a voicemail or go to www.gospelrevolution.com and hit the connect link. So now it's good night from myself, Don Bartlett, from the GR Studios right here in Gospel City, USA.
And it's good night from Michael Williams from right here in the Secret City, USA. Thanking you so much for all that you guys do. We really do love you. It's easy to love when we've been loved, and that's all we're doing is loving out of that which we have received. We're not giving you something that we have not already received ourselves. We hope that this is, I've got to go back and listen to all of this, Don.
Yeah, really.
I've got to go back and listen to all this, because this has been, I've taught on Hebrews chapter 12 more times than I can think of. And this has brought focus to this that I have never seen before. So give us your comments. Let us know what you learned, even if it's just a tidbit. I know just about every 5 minutes you had a bomb dropped on you as to what this actually was saying in context. And so let us know. Let us know. Let us know we're speaking to you. Let us know you're hearing. We love you.
And we'll be here next week just to do the same thing all over again. But
it gets better.
When I die, just bury me at Walmart. So my wife will come and visit me. Just put my ashes next to towels and curtains, and make sure there's a discount sign she'll see. Make sure her credit cards all stay paid up. Then I won't have to wonder where she'll be. When I die, just bury me at Walmart. So my wife will come and visit me. Now, I ain't saying she's a shopaholic, but she goes shopping with an 18-wheeler. Every time I say, oh baby, let's frolic, she says they're open all night and I gotta be there. Now I don't mind her looking for a bargain, but we've got three garages of sale debris. Please don't get me wrong, I really love Walmart, but her shopping's gonna be the end of me. So when I die, just bury me at Walmart, so my wife will come and visit me. Just put my ashes next to sheets or french fries, and make sure there's a discount sign near me. Make sure her credit cards all stay paid up, so I won't have to wonder where she'll be. When I die, just bury me at Walmart, so my wife will come and visit me. doubt she's been my good companion. And I'm so thankful she has loved me truly. But her passion for those celebrations, yeehaw, has gotten my dander up and blood pressure unruly. I keep hoping like raisins this thing too will pass, but I'm all in by spinning insanity. Please don't get me wrong, I shop at Walmart, but her shopping's gonna be the death of me. So when I die, just bury me at Walmart, so my wife will come and visit me. Just put my ashes next to bras or doodads, and make sure there's a discount sign near me. Make sure her credit cards all stay paid up, then I won't have to wonder where she'll be. When I die, just bury me at Walmart, so my wife will come and visit me. Just let my ashes roll around on Walmart, so my wife will come and visit me.
Attention shoppers, did someone lose an urn with a bunch of ashes in it? Would you please claim it at loading dock number 7, please?
I guess I'm gonna get a small travel trailer and put it in Walmart's parking lot, so I can see my wife more often. Credit cards, no down payment, no interest till next March. Holy moly, plastic man.
Walmart, gospel revolution.